The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, 7 wins in a row for Liverpool, but have Sheffield United shown everyone else how to play them? City win again with another from the De Bruyne assists collection. Leicester move into third with their biggest ever Premier League win, while Spurs almost Serge Aurier themselves in the foot at home to Southampton. It's tight at the top in Spain. Is La Liga now the best league in the world? Or is that the Bundesliga, where 1 point separates the top six? We'll round up all of that, talk about the Yeovil ball boys getting sent off, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm good.
It's nice to see you.
Isn't it just?
Tim Stillman, how are you?
Hello there, not too bad, thank
you. Nice to see you. Hi, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
We're in dangerous territory, Barry, aren't we? Because time of recording, 10:15 a.m, you've had no food and no cigarettes.
Correct. I may be irritable, or more irritable than usual, so tread very carefully.
Do we think sort of part three is when we'll really start to see you fade?
I'm excited. I might have a whitey.
Currently, you seem quite upbeat.
Yeah, I'm trying hard.
Maybe this is the secret.
We'll see.
Okay. Let's start then with Leicester City. A 5-0 win over Newcastle yesterday. Is it too far to suggest, Lars, that Isaac Hayden's red was the game-changing moment?
Well, you maybe, but I thought Leicester were well on top before that as well. But obviously, being as good on the counter as they are when Newcastle are in the situation when they're one man down and one goal down, and they have to play against Leicester, who are as good as they are on the counter, that's a very bad place for Newcastle to be. So at that point, it seems very unlikely that they're coming back into it.
But they weren't doing anything.
No, they weren't. And I think there's a lot of worry about their situation and Steve Bruce and all of this. I mean, you look at the table, they're only like 2 points behind Southampton and all of those. But the problem is you look at their performances and it's really, really hard to say what they're trying to do and if they're really good at anything. But getting beat and getting well beat away to Leicester when you have one man down for half the game, there's a lot of shame in that. Leicester are a good team this season. But they just look really shambolic. They don't seem very well structured in defence. They don't seem to counter with any sort of incision and they don't look after the ball very well. So what are they really good at? It's very hard to say.
Surrender is a dangerous word in this day and age, Barry, but Steve Bruce said this was a complete surrender from his side. Effort is a big, big part of the game. We've not done enough. And he looked so big draggled, didn't he?
He shouldn't be using that sort of inflammatory language in today's political climate. I would... Like Lars said, there's no great shame in losing with 10 men to Leicester, you know, getting a hiding, but that was a shameful performance by Newcastle's players. I'm not sure how much of the blame can be put at Steve Bruce's door, but it's certainly not going to help the case of a manager who the fans didn't want in the first place and doesn't seem to be doing very well. One good performance against Tottenham, notwithstanding. They were awful yesterday, really threw in the towel in the second half. Much has been made of, you know, how unpopular Mike Ashley is. We have these discussions about Newcastle nearly every year, apart from maybe last season when they were doing okay under Rafael Benitez. Ashley, I suppose, could, you know, fans say he doesn't invest in the club. He's not ambitious. He could argue that he got Almiron in, he got Joe Linton in, broke the club record transfer fee twice in a row. It's not working out with Joe Linton so far. Almiron's having a shocking season. You know, he's been dreadful so far this season. And I would say on the evidence of what I've seen so far this season, Newcastle are a shoo-in to get relegated.
Tim, on that sending off, we were just chatting before we started recording. It seemed like everyone thought it was a red card except for Chris Sutton and Lars's dad.
And Isaac Hayden.
Yes. Although he arguably had a vested interest in all of this. That's a definite red card, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I couldn't work out what he was so upset about, because when I first saw the tackle, I thought, you know, talking about the situation at Newcastle at the moment, and you wonder if that's a particularly happy camp, that looked like the tackle of someone who was trying to get sent off. And, you know, he succeeded admirably, but then he seemed really, really upset about it. And I couldn't quite work out why. But I mean, on Newcastle, I watched them play against Brighton last weekend as well. And if Brighton had Jamie Vardy up front, Newcastle probably would have lost that game 5-0 as well. They just seem to have this really insipid, sit back and do nothing kind of approach. And I agree with Barry. I think they're absolutely shoo-in to get relegated, possibly in bottom position.
Yeah, you, Tim, with your South American knowledge, might know Joe Ellington more than we do, but just from watching him in Germany at Hoffenheim, he does a lot of useful things on the pitch, but he's not maybe a natural goal scorer.
No, and I think this is a big problem for Newcastle as well. One of the things they did have going for them last season was that combination of Rondon and Iosi Perez up front, you know, who are both able to kind of hold the ball up, and they played off of each other quite well, and they're trying to recreate that with Almiron and Joe Ellington at the moment, and it's just not coming off. Whether it will in time, I'm not sure, but it doesn't look like it at the moment.
Yeah, I didn't think they could work with them too, but then Almiron was stuck out on the right here, which isn't really his position at all, so no. That's slightly odd.
You mentioned Jamie Vardy, Tim. 85 Premier League goals in 183 games. Cristiano Ronaldo, 84 goals in 196 games. Who is better?
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Okay, thanks, Barry.
But
we found the moment there is whether he needs a cigarette. But it was early in the pod.
But Barry's grumpiness aside, there should be a moment of appreciation for Jamie Vardy here, who just, you think when a guy is, he's past 30 now and he's sort of a speedy in-behind striker, that he should be losing his pace and become slow and bad and useless, but he's still going. He's an absolutely phenomenal guy. And I mean, for someone who doesn't seem to treat his body quite like a temple, he's in remarkable nick for a guy who has, that birth date, and he's looking very good.
Yeah, he moved level on goals with Fernando Torres, Luis Zaha and Eden Hazard in the all-time list. 2 behind Bergkamp, 3 behind Kevin Davis.
I did have a very cheeky flutter on him as top scorer this season in the Premier League at a very, very decent, I think 16-1 or something.
Right.
So I'm watching this with interest.
I mean, Lexang says, are Leicester out of the Everton Cup? And it does look like it, doesn't it? They're up to third.
Way too good.
Up to third, 2 points off Manchester City. But can they maintain this, Baz?
Yeah, I don't see why not. They can maintain this, and Manchester United are in a pretty sorry state. I can see Chelsea possibly dropping out of the top four. I could see Arsenal dropping out of the top four. I could see Spurs dropping out of the top four. They won't all drop out, but a couple of them very well might. And Leicester look best equipped to capitalise.
Alan Smith on Sky gave man of the match to Yuri Tielemans. Dennis Praet came in for Maddison, who wasn't playing. Ian says, do Leicester have the best midfield apart from Liverpool and Manchester City?
They might well do, yes. And it's quite interesting, that question about whether they can maintain this, because I still perhaps have some doubts, but I'm going to keep them a bit quiet, because there was a time when Leicester were in a good position in the league not long ago, and I kind of harboured some doubts about whether they could keep it up, and that didn't turn out too well. I think the interesting thing is, and what they've done since they've won the league, is they've turned into one of these clubs who sell players for really good prices and then bring in other really good players with that money. And then they'll probably sell Tielemans and Maddison for insane prices and just keep this kind of production line going. But in terms of whether they can finish in the top six, the way the top six is configured at the moment, if you can finish six, you can finish third, because there's just not much between those kind of teams, between Arsenal, Chelsea and Tottenham.
And just never mind the midfield, we can look at the whole Leicester City team and see which of these guys would do a job for one of the established top six. And Lee Schmeichel, definitely. I think their top teams has had him. Pereira, definitely. Like, Tottenham would be very happy to have him at right back. Either one of the centre halves, I think Arsenal would be more than happy to have in their first 11. Everyone likes Chilwell, so he's there. Ndidi, Tielemans and Maddison, I think, are all absolutely would get a game for top six team. Not that sure about the wide players, but Vardy definitely would. So, I mean, they've got a terrific, terrific first 11.
Is Everyone Likes Chilwell sort of the sequel to Everyone Loves Raymond? It's a sort of a bad Leicester-based sitcom.
I hope it's funnier.
Will says, Brendan Rodgers to replace Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Manchester United. Could it happen? And would it be a good move for either party?
I don't think it would be a good move for Brendan Rodgers. I think Leicester are a far better run club than Manchester United. Just it seems pretty obvious they are. Just their recruitment policy. Everything. They've won a league title more recently than Manchester United, and they look likely to win a league title again before Manchester United do. And what you were saying about their midfield, I would argue their midfield is possibly better than Liverpool's midfield. Ooh. And in Johnny Evans, I think, you know, they sold their second best central defender this summer to Manchester United for £80 million. I think Johnny Evans is... Why Manchester United let him go? Louis van Gaal sold him, and it was just absolute madness. He's an outstanding central defender.
And having sold Maguire, they found Sun Yunchu behind the sofa or something. It turned out they had a really good,
sofa.
Excellent Turkish centre-half there,
yeah,
all along. He seems very good. I think it was Hungarian football writer Tomas Mortimer who described him as being like a good David Luiz, which I think, because he does some wacky things now and again, but he seems to get away with it more often than not.
He barely got a look in last season. I think I suppose he was never going to with Maguire and Johnny Evans.
He's been linked to Manchester City in the last week or so. I guess they need to do something in January, don't they, potentially?
Why wouldn't they sign Johnny Evans?
All right, then, well done, Leicester City. Sheffield United 0, Liverpool 1. Sheffield United played really well in this game, not letting Liverpool play their regular game. I know Liverpool had some chances and it could have been different. Is this, Lars, a blueprint of how to play Liverpool, or is that just reading too much into a game where, you know, had Mane or Salah scored those chances, we would have been talking about a regulation 3-0 win?
No, you're not necessarily wrong in the sense that they kept their shape really well, they were very aggressive, and they don't necessarily just... It's very tempting to describe them as a team that sort of sits back and does the basics well. But I think that the way they denied Liverpool's wide player space, the way they stopped Firmino, I thought was very impressive. No, they did very well, and they were very unlucky not to get anything from it.
Poor Dean Henderson. Because Wijnaldum hit that volley reasonably well, but there are just times to make mistakes, and that's just a really... You know, if you do that in the fourth minute, well, Liverpool probably get another one, it's okay. But for it to finish 1-0, he'll be feeling sick all weekend, won't he?
Yeah, he Taibbed that well and good. I thought Chris Wilder's comments about it afterwards were quite interesting as well. He was kind of decidedly unsympathetic and said, you know, he wants to play at the highest level, he wants to play for England, he's got to do better than that, he's got to concentrate more, which is, you know, I think Chris Wilder's a really interesting manager anyway, but I thought that was a kind of a really interesting, unique kind of way of framing it, because I think most managers in that scenario, at least publicly, would do the arm around the shoulder and maybe give him a bit of a scolding on the training ground. But I thought it was quite interesting doing that quite publicly, and I guess we'll wait and see exactly how that works out.
On the Taibbi level, I don't think it's as bad, is
not
it?
Quite. Because,
you know, it was hit from closer in and with more power.
And with more players in the way, I think. So yeah it wasn't quite on the Taibbi scale. I'd probably put it at about 7 out of 10.
And comparing Matt Letizia and Jeannie Wijnaldum, do we know Jeannie Wijnaldum's views on climate change or not? I found myself confusingly embroiled in a Twitter discussion with Matt Letizia about climate change. We've remained friends through
right
He's not.
Was it a discussion or a spat?
No, it wasn't a spat. And he's not denying it. He's just sceptical.
He's open-minded.
He's open-minded. Yeah.
While simultaneously being quite close-minded.
Well, I don't know.
Where is he on the Trump climate change,
I don't think he's at that level.
Greta Thunberg at 1 to Trump at 10. Where would you have Letiz?
I think he's around a 6.
Ooh.
Maybe.
A free roll.
George Baldock talking about Dean Henderson. He's very upset and he's apologised. I don't think he needs to. Rewind 7 days. He kept us in the game at Everton. Did we all know Dean Henderson was on loan from Manchester United?
Yeah.
Well done, everybody.
Does that mean you didn't?
Do you know what? It was at the back of my mind, but it wasn't at the front, that's for sure.
Well, I heard someone saying over the weekend that he's a very confident young man and struts around and firmly believes he should be Manchester United number one and England number one. So I did feel sorry for him. I no problem with Wilder digging him out publicly, you know, they're both men.
It does make more sense now when Chris Wilder says he wants to play for Manchester United. I was like, why is he picking that club out? You know, Wilder is coming in and trying to make Sheffield, not saying, not sort of patronising his own squad. You know, we are here to compete. And
no, he's very he's proved it
as well, hasn't he? I mean, Sheffield United look better than a lot of the sides in the league.
Yeah, and Chris Wilder in general, we spoke about it earlier in the season on the pod, but just in case of the last sort of 5-6 years he's had management, getting promotions all over the place at different levels with different clubs. I mean, pound for pound, he's done absolutely incredible job. There can't be many managers in the country who've done better than him overall the last couple of years.
I thought their approach in an attacking sense as well was quite interesting. I think if you really want to see how a team is intending to play, the first 5 or 10 minutes is the best time to really watch, because I think that's the time when the game's the least chaotic and the message is fresher in the mind. And they kept putting the ball behind Trent and Alexander-Arnold. They obviously identified that as a potential place where they could hurt Liverpool. And actually, Arsenal tried to do something similar a few weeks ago, and in neither situation did it really work. But I think we'll probably see that more and more, teams identifying Alexander-Arnold as a place to attack.
Next weekend, Liverpool host Leicester. That should be fun, shouldn't it? Interesting to see where, you know, if Leicester change what they do. I mean, they do counter really well. It should be a great game, shouldn't it? And then the two games after that for Liverpool, Manchester United and Spurs. So they win all those three, then they really have guaranteed the league title, haven't they? They've got Salzburg on Wednesday. So Liverpool versus Erling Braut Haaland.
Yes,
he's now on 17 goals in 11 games.
Obviously. But it is an interesting test, though, because with him, so much of it, certainly in the Austrian league, is about his size and his speed, right? So he's just bullying the players physically. Whereas you coming up against Virgil van Dijk, it's one of the few defenders in the world who can probably match him. So it'll be a very interesting test for young Haaland.
Is everyone in the Austrian league sort of tiny? What?
They're not. That's fair. But I think they're maybe not quite the athletic specimens that young Erling Braut Haaland is.
Austrian goals, like Dutch goals, dog goals, you know, four.
Which is watching highlights from. He seems to just run past and over and through people at will. But it is an interesting thing about Haaland. It's easy to look at his size and athletic capability and think that's what it is. But he was actually not. He grew very quickly in his sort of mid to late teens. He grew something like 17 centimetres in 2 years.
Wow.
Which is quite unusual. And he put on
redwood.
Yeah, and he put on something like, I think Solskjaer said this, he put on something like 40 pounds of muscle in 2 seasons. So like his physique completely changed over a couple of years. But that does mean that when he was learning the game, when he was younger, he couldn't like bully players physically. So he's not someone who's gotten ahead in his footballing life through being just a physical specimen. He's had to learn to move and be clever with the ball.
So
I think that's something we're seeing as well.
He had a good touch for a small man. And now
well, he had a good touch for a regular size man.
Okay.
And now he's just turned into this giant.
He was ill on Saturday. Do we know if he's going to be better? I mean, you've got your finger on the pulse. I mean, not literally.
Not really, no. I don't have my finger on his pulse. That would be weird.
Hopefully he will be better. Everton 1, Manchester City 3. Everton had 12 shots, 8 on target. City had 29 on target. This game could have had a lot more goals than the 4 we saw. Barry, Everton pushed City here, didn't they?
Yeah, and they lost. It was a decent performance from Everton in defeat, but a defeat nonetheless, much like Sheffield United's performance against Liverpool was decent, but a defeat nonetheless. Everton fans can take, a certain amount of heart from it, but they could go out in their next game and just not be very good again. It was an entertaining game. I'm not sure what exactly Everton fans can really take from it.
A bit of enthusiasm, maybe?
Yeah, there was a lot of fight there. I think if you come up, if you're not doing very well and you can come up against Man City, and you'd take that performance, I think. Going into the game, you're worried about just being spanked and it going very, very badly wrong, sort of in sort of Watford type of way. And I thought they were very, very competitive in the game. If they perform like that against other teams, they should do a lot better than they have done.
That's my point, though. I don't think they will perform like that against other teams, and all available evidence, apart from this game so far this season, kind of suggests that it's not really their MO to perform like this against other teams. Maybe they just raised their game because they didn't want to get the kind of spanking that Watford got last weekend.
And actually, in the first half, I don't think Everton really did compete that much. I mean, the first kind of 20, 30 minutes, I was watching it thinking, you know, Manchester City look like they can score whenever they want. Something kind of changed a bit, I think, in the second half, and Everton did compete more. But in that first half, it really looked like it was going to be a rollover. In fact, this performance was very Everton in that it was kind of good in some patches, bad in other patches, but overall just didn't do the job.
I thought it was after the equaliser, actually, that Everton seemed to... Yeah, I mean, maybe that was Man City freaking out a little bit. I don't know, because you're right, they were enormously comfortable before that. It was one of those moments when you watch especially Kevin De Bruyne in this game and you think he is just amazing, like the best player in the league for my money. And if you, all else being equal, if you had to pay money to watch someone play football in the Premier League at the moment, he's just terrific.
8 assists already this season. The most for him in a season is 20, 2014-15 for Wolfsburg. So he could...
You'd imagine that he'll smash that. And also worth mentioning Riyad Mahrez, as he seems to be kind of coming into his own. He was very good as well. And with the sort of wonderful Pep Guardiola systems, you do feel sometimes you could use a player in there who can break up the patterns a little bit and do something unpredictable and unexpected and introduce a little bit of chaos. Now, I expect that was the idea behind his signing, and he was really doing that.
Should Pickford save that free kick?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Just going back to De Bruyne, actually, with his 8 assists, a lot of them are very similar as well. He keeps pulling over to that right-hand side, and it's mm-hmm. actually quite a clever position to take up, because if you're the opposition, who's responsible for you when you're not quite on the right wing and you're not quite in central midfield? And he's just pulling over to the corner of the box and whipping those crosses in, and it's hugely effective.
Is he so good that he's putting that on Jesus's head, or is he just putting it into... absolutely devastating area.
I thought so first that was an amazing cross, and then you look at the replay and actually Jesus has done really well was my feeling, because when you see the curve of the ball first and the area it goes into, you think, oh, that's genius, that is. But every time I saw the replay, you realise actually he had to work a little bit to get that on target, Jesus.
It's your corridor of uncertainty, isn't it? The goalkeeper isn't quite sure whether to come, and the striker is fairly sure roughly where it's going to be.
That was a good header, and not as good as Dominic Calvert-Lewin's from naught centimetres, I believe it was. And Seamus Coleman looked confused, but you don't think Barry upset?
I wouldn't imagine so. I mean, it would be nice to get the goal. I think Seamus Coleman's a fullback. He's been around long enough not to be particularly fussed over whether he gets his name on the score sheet or not. I mean, I suppose it depends on the individual and their ego, doesn't it? I don't think it would bother me. It might bother you on a football pitch. I wouldn't be going out of my way to claim it.
I just want to know how the Calvert-Lewin header shows up on XG. That's got to be a firm 1.0, surely.
Check that, actually.
Theo Walcott... producer Jonathan really laying in to Theo Walcott. He wrote this: Theo Walcott with the most Theo Walcott injury, knocked out cold by a football. shame he didn't sit up and make two circles with his fingers for 0-0. Slightly harsh on poor Theo. Marker going with big news that Giovanni Van Bronckhorst has signed a contract with Manchester City, accepting an unspecified, quote, inside role, so he can learn about how the club works ahead of potentially succeeding Guardiola.
Right, I was unaware of that, but that does seem really odd,
doesn't
because
it?
I would have presumed Mikel Arteta was being groomed to succeed Pep Guardiola, or indeed, you know, take over as interim manager if Pep decides to go on one of his sabbaticals or whatever, backpacking around India or South America or whatever.
He managed Feyenoord from 2015 to 2019.
Yeah, won the league, if I recall correctly, but I don't remember any details.
In other Pep news, he is continuing to dig a hole for himself with this Bernardo Silva incident. Here's his latest quote: "They judged one joke. I judged 3 years every single day with him and how he is and his friendship. Nothing more to add. It's a cartoon and the face is quite similar. The same happened 1,000,000,000 times with white people. It's the same. It was a cartoon. It was just a joke. And that's all." Bernardo Silva has apparently written to the FA to express regret for any offence caused as they investigate the incident. Could lead to a 6-game ban if he's found guilty of wrongdoing.
You say Pep is digging a hole for himself. I suppose to an extent he is, but that is clearly his strongly held opinion. it's one I couldn't disagree with more, and most people, I think, couldn't disagree
but
with more.
I think he's also slightly misunderstanding the charge. I don't think most kind of mature people are saying that Bernardo Silva is some like card-carrying racist, but you can do racist or racially insensitive things without actually being a racist.
And also whilst speaking many languages and having been a nice guy. Not the point.
I think the way City have handled this overall has just been, all they had to say was, you know, look, he didn't mean it, but we understand that these things, when they're in the public domain, that you know, we'll make sure it doesn't happen again, basically, and we'll make sure he understands why, although his intention wasn't to offend, why it could be offensive. That's all they had to say, and I think prolonged it.
I think maybe the problem is that there's such an ingrained sense of injustice at City that they're absolutely convinced the media are out to get them. So anything that, you know, controversial that envelops or that one of their players is involved in, their automatic reaction, their default reaction is defend and attack the media rather
than... They're not the only football club to do that, are they?
I would say in recent times they are the worst for doing that.
Another quote from Pep is, if someone is offended, I can understand it. Bernardo is maybe going to take a lesson and it's not going to happen again. So sort of mixed messages, I guess.
We used to from Pep. Send DMs, like the whole "it's a private joke" thing. It's not. If you tweet it, it's no longer a private joke. It absolutely is a public joke by definition.
Man City host Dinamo Zagreb on Tuesday, the first time they've ever met. Zagreb have won their last two games 7-0 and 4-0. So this could be 8-all, couldn't it?
They really sort of caught Atalanta sort of flat-footed by pressing really high and playing in a way they hadn't really been playing before. So that they might try to do something similar to City and try to shock them. I mean, I think we've seen that one of the ways you can disrupt City is by pressing them high and early so they don't get into their rhythm. But that carries a lot of risk with it, of course, because you can get destroyed on the counter.
Now tonight, Tim, you're off to Old Trafford to watch your plucky Arsenal take on the behemoths of the Premier League, Manchester United. Good news, you've confirmed who your captain is. It's Granit Xhaka, and everyone's very happy about it.
Yeah. It's quite interesting. So personally, I don't really care who the captain is. I don't think it's important. I think leadership is important. I don't think captaincy is. I think there's two things to this that have kind of, I wouldn't say that of course discussion, shall we say. First of all, a lot of people, myself included, don't think that Xhaka should be an automatic pick. So there's some anxiety there. And also there's the length of time it took to make this decision and then the kind of palming it off onto the players. I think it just looks like another example of Emery being a little bit indecisive with something that could have been decided in a much more straightforward fashion much earlier.
This summer, three of last season's captains left, Cech, Koscielny and Ramsey. Then Nacho Monreal captained the team this season against Burnley before leaving a fortnight later. Is this how you force players out of the club?
I mean, it goes back further than that as well. Most of it, you know, Fabregas, Van Persie, William Gallas had the armband unceremoniously taken off of him. So it is quite contentious in the last kind of decade or so.
That was an odd appointment, though, William Gallas, captain of Arsenal.
I got it at the time, but it didn't. It clearly didn't work.
Arsenal are, I mean, it's a small sample size. It's early. They've played against Liverpool, that sort of thing. But they've conceded more shots per game than any other team in the league, which is not great if you're Arsenal. That's not really where you want to be.
But this is a bizarre game tonight, isn't it? Because you look at it and you think, well, I mean, it should be a shoe-in for Arsenal, given how, you know, the crisis of injuries for Manchester United and how sort of poor their squad is. But you could easily see Manchester United winning this game 3-0.
And it's an odd one, because United create very little. I mean, if you look at their expected goals, aside from set pieces, it's pathetic. But they're also surprisingly solid at the back so far this season, whereas Arsenal are the complete opposite. Quite dangerous going forward, but a complete madhouse at the back. So it could be anything, this game, really.
If you're Mason Greenwood, this is the game you want to launch your career, quite frankly, which is a service Arsenal rendered very nicely for Marcus Rashford.
They did,
as well,
didn't they?
But notable Arsenal watcher Tim Stillman, do you have a theory about why they are such a madhouse at the back?
I think it's to do with the midfield. At the moment, Arsenal are playing without their first-choice fullbacks, and I don't think Unai Emery trusts either of them. So what you're seeing is the central midfielders are being pulled wide to try and protect the fullbacks, and that leaves a central trio of Granit Xhaka, David Luiz and Sokratis. It exposes them, for which I feel sorry for them, but also that is a bit of an exploding clown car to leave exposed.
Barry, what would your dream be for this game tonight?
My dream?
Mm. You sit down to watch it. What would you like to pan out to give you the most amount of pleasure?
I would like for it to be abandoned after 3 minutes due to torrential rain, and then I could continue watching something else on Netflix.
Oh, excellent.
Like yourself, I find it hard to call. Arsenal should win. They may well do. I think Roy Keane is going to be punditing on Sky, and he will get very agitated and angry with Manchester United, whether they win or lose, one imagines. But I can see United rousing themselves to get a result in this one.
But what will annoy Keane more? The sort of, I mean, Pogba could be back, so there's that. But there's also the sort of surrealist comedy of the Arsenal defence that could also set him off a little bit. It's just high blood pressure all around.
Yeah. I imagine the headlines tomorrow will be about what Roy Keane says, what Gary Neville says, what Jamie Carragher says, rather than anything that's actually happened on the pitch.
I did enjoy Gary Neville's bit of comedy commentary.
His observational stand-up.
Yeah.
No, the Pleasance last August.
Open mic night.
Towards the
end. Ever found when you get on the bus?
What's the deal with peanuts?
Towards the end of the Everton City game, where Pickford got himself into trouble rushing out towards the sideline, and the chance wasn't converted, and there was a close-up of Pickford who was having a bit of a laugh. And Neville was very cross on the commentary. So, don't know what he's laughing about. You know, he's already, he should have saved the second goal. He's almost given up a goal there. It's not funny. He was just
angry granddad.
Really cross about
angry
it.
Angry school teacher.
Yeah. Disgusted.
Anyway. Well, look, we hope whatever your dreams for that game come true. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at White Hart Lane. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Got some live shows to tell you all about. On the 30th of October, me, Barry, Barney Ronay and Nicky Bandini take on science at the Science Museum. The good news, Barry, is that Football Weekly have sold out their allocation, but there are still some seats in the away end. No, the home end. We're the away team, aren't we? It is at the Science Museum. So no club colours if you buy a ticket in the Science Museum end.
But I think that just shows how fickle the science supporters are. And always have been.
Well, given how science is struggling now, yeah, Matt Letizia has added his weight behind the non-science
debate. They need to really just support their team when they're struggling. It's, you know, it's terrible. It's not like they're owned by Mike Ashley or anything. They've got nothing to boycott.
Yeah, so
you know,
look,
science.
Having been at almost all of our live shows and seen the demographic that attends,
yeah,
I'm pretty confident whether they wear colours or not, they will be easily discernible in the science end.
But who knows what the science fans look like? I mean,
well, I presume they all have egg-shaped heads and
well, they're in lab coats,
white coats, and
I'm thinking I should go
holding
now.
Liebig condensers.
I could go and just, you know, lend my weight behind the science and
or
the
you
crowd.
Could, or you could be like the Football Weekly Ultra Man. You could have a megaphone.
Well,
lead the chance.
And just between you guys and science, you know, my loyalties are a little bit split, to be honest.
I think we'll be humiliated. But Barney's there and he's intelligent. Yeah. The 20th of December, Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. Me, you, Lars, Jonathan Wilson, plus one more. So come along to Leeds. January the 27th, Liberty Hall, Dublin. Max, Barry, plus two more. So we look forward to seeing you in Ireland.
That should be a lot of fun. I was at the Irish shows this year, and one of the most fun times I've had in a work capacity, I think.
Was it in the bar afterwards?
No, we're not talking about that.
Right, Tottenham Hotspur 2, Southampton 1. Lars, you were there.
I was. Yeah. It was interesting.
Jermaine Genus on Match of the Day said this was a season-defining moment for Spurs. Would you agree with that?
It did feel significant in the stadium that they were able to rescue the situation, because the first half was, well, up until the red card, they were some good quality and show, and then some spectacular own goals. I mean, it's the Aurier thing. I'm just baffled by how a guy who's been a full-time pro for what 10 years now. I mean, the first tackle is, it's needless, but you can see, I mean, Boufal is a bit of a tricky customer. There's maybe a case to be made for a fullback that you want to go through him and let him know you're there, as the old school people would say. But on a yellow card, like the thing he does with Bertrand, I mean, it's, you could argue it's a little bit soft, but as a fullback, if you're on a yellow card and the guy's gone past you, don't pull his shirt. Like, you'd be disappointed if you're the coach of an under-12s team and your fullback does that. Then you're thinking, lad, you're an idiot. What are you doing? Where, this guy's been a pro for 10 years.
When
it's baffling.
When you watched it on camera and you could see he did it, and you could see Vertonghen and Alderweireld both running away, and they both just looked to the sky. They didn't even bother looking back. They were like, we can't even complain about this.
And it was just strange being in the stadium to hear the sound of 60,000 people just trying to, what did, he did what, but why?
In a way, we're talking about Alderweireld looked more annoyed with Aurier than they did with Hugo Lloris, what, a few minutes later.
I think so, because I don't know, we're kind of here with Lloris at this point, aren't we, that we know he has that kind of mistake in him, but you also know he'll probably come up with a couple of big saves as well, which he did. And I thought it was interesting, after he made the mistake, it was almost as if the team was making a point out of playing back passes to him. They played quite a few back passes to him quite shortly after the mistake, almost as if to send a message to him that we still trust you and it's fine. But it was also interesting having... Every time they did, you had certainly half of the 60,000 people going, oh no! So it was sort of, it was quite a nervy atmosphere.
But although, they shouldn't, should they? Because Lloris is not quite good enough on the ball. He's okay, but he plays these kind of drifty balls to fullbacks that aren't quick enough.
Yeah.
And so Danny Rose or Aurier, if he's on the ball, whoever's on the pitch, has to sort of control it on their chest as someone's coming in to just whip the ball off them.
Yeah, and he should not do Cruyff turns, I think, in his own 6-yard box. I think that's a general sort of thing he should. But I like Pochettino just coming out and accepting responsibility, saying, I'm the one who's asking him to play like this, so, you know, you should blame me instead of him. But more to the first question you asked about 16 minutes ago, it did feel significant because there's been a lot made of the lack of harmony and the different agendas in the Spurs squad, but having this sort of moment where they were down to 10 men for a long time and they had to really dig in, and they had to suffer against the Southampton team, who played quite well, I thought, for a lot of it. I mean, they're not very effective in front of goal, but they do a lot of things right. I think that could be a sort of a morale-building moment. I thought Lamela was terrific when he came on for the last half hour, just in a situation where the team's really under pressure. And it's just every time he got the ball, he either kept it or made something happen or drew a foul. He just completely got it, Lamela. And I had this sort of moment where you wonder about, what is it about Lamela that makes Pochettino be so patient with him and give him so many chances? Because he's not bad, but he also maybe doesn't offer as much as you want him to. And that was one of those games where I kind of think, I guess I can kind of understand what it is that Pochettino sees in him. He's a very good attitude and very helpful.
You mentioned the agendas. Tommy says, I was at the Spurs game on Saturday. Kane is refusing to pass to Eriksen. So many times the easy, obvious pass was on. Kane would rather give the ball away than pass to him. Extraordinary. Did you see that? Or is
there
Tommy...
was one moment in particular where if it had been Salah and Mane, the internet would have been ablaze. But I feel like that's probably more Kane wanting to score goals and being a goal scorer and being used to take that responsibility and shoot whenever he can, rather than him specifically not passing to Eriksen. That was my view.
I was going to say, like, that just, maybe that's just like a confirmation bias thing, that people are looking for these things at the moment, because Kane's always been a kind of shoot on sight type of striker, high volume. And, you know, there was famously the World Cup semi-final where he could have passed to Raheem Sterling and, you know, took the shot. I just think that's the kind of player Kane is.
Yeah, and actually, Barry, he looked sort of like peak Kane, didn't he?
Yeah, I thought he played very well, although I wouldn't agree with Jermaine Genius's assessment that this could be a season-turning moment or season-changing moment for Spurs. Obviously, only time will tell, but I thought Southampton should have won this game. I thought they were the better team. Mayoshida was foiled by a brilliant save from Lloris, as was James Ward-Prowse, and Danny Ings missed a sitter. So.
Yeah, I really feel for Hasenhüttl, because I think Southampton, they look well organised. They press in the right areas. The players look like they know what they're meant to do, but they're not putting away their chances and they're not keeping clean sheets, and that's a really bad combination of things to have in football. So yeah, if this goes on, you can easily see Hasenhüttl get sacked at some point this season, and that would be very harsh, but football is the way it is.
How's Ndombele looking? He scored 2 from 4 shots this season. He only scored 1, I think, in
terrific.
60 games
no,
before
I
that.
Thought he looked great. And or still betting into the league, still betting into the team, but he has a little bit of everything, and I think he's going to be a terrific midfielder for Tottenham. Really, really good.
Spurs play Bayern on Tuesday. Tough game, right?
Very tough, yes. I'd make Bayern slight favourites. I mean, I think they're a better team, and I think even though this was a good sort of morale building exercise, I wouldn't say Spurs are sort of home dry. I think the right back thing is a problem, because if Aurier isn't going to grow up or turn into a reliable player, then you've got Walker Peters, who's very young and inexperienced, and you've got Foyth, who's been injured, so it's not a good place. I mean, Sissoko actually wasn't bad in that he just kind of quietly got things done, which I think is what you want from a fullback, so maybe that's the future.
Chelsea 2, Brighton 0. Another team, Tim, making a mistake while trying to play out from the back. How do you avoid it as a team? Producer Jonathan said, look, do you make a call where you say, listen, if we've had five passes after the goal kick, just lump the thing. I mean, just something to say, this isn't working right now. We can try it again next passage of play, but just get rid.
Yeah, I think that's going on with a lot of teams at the moment, because to me, or I think, well, more than just to me, to most people, the idea of playing out from the back is to kind of suck your opponents in. And actually what you can then do, once you've done it a few times, and Lord knows, I know this from watching Arsenal this season, you know, the teams really, really push up, and then you think, well, okay, now you've really got a chance to go over the top of them. And I'm not sure a lot of teams have quite got that yet. I remember there was a game between City and Spurs a couple of seasons ago where Spurs decided to press right up, and Edison just went, okay, I'm going to go right over the top of you then. And I think there are a lot of teams who are just struggling with that kind of that mixture, which to me is kind of serves the whole point of playing out from the back.
Willian's first goal of the season. Hudson-Odoi gave it to him after a nice bit of dribbling from him. He's a lovely player on the pitch in the Premier League for the first time since April. And you hope now that he is a regular, and this is something that Maurizio Sarri didn't want to do, and maybe young Frank Lampard will.
Yeah, quite possibly, because he Lampard, a lot's been made of the kind of the youth projects, but actually, and it's not entirely forced, because there are some senior players who are being left out, like Giroud, for example, because he's decided to opt for younger players. But I know Lampard said something about Willian a couple of weeks ago, where he said he was a really kind of positive influence. And I think if you're going to blood young players, then yes, you definitely want someone who's quite experienced. And Chelsea aren't short of wide players, wide attackers, but... he kind of came into the season with an injury. He got injured at Copa America, so that's probably affected him to this point. But I'd imagine he'll play more often than not now.
I guess the point that's worth making about the Chelsea youth project, as it is that a lot of these players who have played a lot and played well in the Championship. I mean, Tomori, Mount and Abraham have all got Championship campaigns behind them, and actually playing in the Premier League is a logical next step for them. It's not like that he's just, oh, we don't have any players, we'll throw on some kids, as someone might be doing in Manchester. These are players who it makes sense for them to play in the Premier League now, and it's good that they're getting that chance, and it's something that I think they'll benefit from in the years to come.
Chelsea's first clean sheet of the season in all competitions. Only two teams, Norwich and Watford, have conceded more so far this season. It's quite an extraordinary stat, that.
Why?
Why is it extraordinary?
Yeah.
Well, I would have expected more teams to concede more goals. And I'd expected Chelsea to have had a clean sheet by now.
Yeah, I'm just not sure why you would expect that. Didn't we discuss, like, a couple of weeks ago that due to Frank Lampard's insistence on not having mirrors of any kind in his car, of only ever being interested in going forward, he doesn't pay that much attention to what's going on at the back.
Shall I dial it down from extraordinary to slightly surprising?
Well, if that's what you feel, that's fine. But I'm not particularly surprised. Okay. But
maybe I'm guilty of sensationalising Chelsea's defensive issues.
Well, I just think everyone in the media, or quite a lot of people, seem to be guilty of sensationalising Frank Lampard's abilities as a manager, when there isn't a huge amount of evidence to suggest that he's anything special yet. He may well turn into a very good manager, but I remain unconvinced.
And Dan Burn did hit the bar at 1-0, and he is a big man, isn't he? All 6 foot seven of him.
I'm very worried about... Well, not very worried. Now I'm sensational. I don't really care, but it makes no difference to my life whatsoever how bright and fair. But I worry for them. Graham Potter, I expected more from it, still early doors, just as it is with Frank Lampard, to say whether or not he'd be able to hack it. But it doesn't quite seem to be working for him. I mean, Chelsea really dominated that game. Brighton barely got a look in. Brighton are looking very toothless. And failed to score against Newcastle last weekend in a game they probably should have won and barely got a look in this game.
I am very worried. I do care, because I think it's... I think Potter is terrific, and I think it's really good that an English club has, a Premier League club has taken a chance on someone like him. But what he's trying to do, he's trying to take a team that's played, shall we say, slightly agricultural football under Chris Hughton and just about stayed up for two seasons, and he's trying to make them a much ball-playing team in a league where you famously have very little time on the training ground to work on stuff. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and it would be really good, I think, for English football overall if someone like him succeeded, and it would be a bit sad if he didn't.
And I think a little bit like Newcastle, they've got this kind of issue up front where the last couple of seasons they've kind of settled on putting crosses in for Glenn Murray, which has kind of given them a little bit of success. And obviously Potter doesn't really want them to play like that, but the question is, does he have a striker who fits their kind of style of play? Because Glenn Murray's still there, right? I haven't but if you want to play Glenn Murray up front, you've got to play a certain way, which Graham Potter probably doesn't want to play. So I think when I've seen them, they've played broadly quite well, but you're right, they've just looked completely toothless.
Chelsea go to Lille on Wednesday in the Champions League. Do you want some breaking news, everybody?
Yes.
Football Weekly Live Christmas special has been announced.
Oh.
November the 27th, me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Ellis James at playing the O2, Barry.
Woo.
Just the Indigo. No, we're not playing the whole O2, Barry. That would be ambitious.
It would be ambitious, yes.
The Indigo at the O2, which is... How many is that hold, Jonathan?
2,500?
No, 1,700.
1,700.
Okay. So what's that? It's a good conference attendance, isn't it? It's good National League attendance if we can fill that. So buy a ticket for yourself and bring everyone you know. That's what I suggest. So yes, Football Weekly Live Christmas special. Me, Baz Wilson, Ellis James, 27th of November. Indigo at the O2. It is Macclesfield Town's average attendance. There we are. Bournemouth 2, West Ham 2. This was a fun game, wasn't it? And VAR is so often taken away, but it giveth with Josh King's equaliser.
The VAR taketh away.
It does. Josh King's equaliser was flagged for offside, and it was overruled by Andrew Madley, the VAR. Is he related to Bobby Madley, Andrew Madley? Is it a family of referees? Perhaps not the important question.
Bobby Madley, who's in Norway, by the way, having a good time.
Is he? Yeah. So that was...
I'd like to think he's related to Richard Madley.
Okay, that's Richard Madeley. So he can't be related to him.
What's the difference?
An E, an important E in the names.
All right.
He is Bobby Madley's older brother. There we go. On a scale from Andros Townsend to Arjen Robben, in the getting it onto his left foot and bending it in the corner, where do we put Yarmolenko?
But I feel Yarmolenko is in his own category, because he's an odd player. He does not have the build to be a winger. It's very strange that he's never been retooled to be a centre forward because of his whole stature and the way he plays. But he is quite effective at what he does. It's just an unusual thing to see.
Yeah, he gives me that kind of slightly Arnautovic vibe.
Except he runs more.
Well, that's a pretty low bar.
On the running scale, on the Arnautovic running scale of Arnautovic to running at all, he is above Arnautovic. Aaron Cresswell, following his free kick last week, got another one. First time in his career he scored in consecutive games. West Ham are fourth, Barry. Can they maintain this?
I think their chances of doing so aren't as good as Leicester's, but it's a very good West Ham team. They've got a very good manager who I think continues to be a bit underrated in England. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why, but they and Leicester certainly look the most likely to trouble the top four. I don't trust West Ham enough for them. I wouldn't be confident of them maintaining this good progress.
Do you not trust West Ham because of the last 43 years of watching
West Ham? Yes, something like that.
5-7 for Callum Wilson.
You guys mentioned it after the United game. They have a terrific front line, West Ham. You do wonder about their defences, if they'll ever hold enough clean sheets and whatever. But also about Yarmolenko, instead of just writing it off as a man with an odd shape. I mean, it's worth noting that he's come back from a horrific injury. And I think that's one of those things that those of us who've not played football at any sort of serious level, just the agony of knowing that you're one of millions hundreds of people who wanted to do this for a living, and through both talent and hard work and getting the right breaks, you've ended up doing it. And then you get to a point where, because of something in your body that you can't control, you can't do your job for over a year. I think that the psychology of that is something that we don't, it's hard to really understand, and it's good to see him back and working out for him.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that.
I think the thing, I think you're right with West Ham, is possibly their defence, and it looks like they're going to lose Lucas Fabianski for a couple of months as well. But I think with West Ham, I think if you're going to be a team in that kind of area of the table, you might as well be good fun. And I think that's what they've become under Pellegrini. They've become a team who'll probably finish 7th or 8th, but they'll probably have a fairly good time doing it.
5-7 for Callum Wilson. You could say the same for Bournemouth, right? Yeah. Couldn't you? Good fun. He had a huge chance at 2-1. Almost had too much time on his hands. And Nathan Ake had that goal ruled out. That's the correct decision, isn't it? He was definitely interfering.
Yeah. I think so. He was standing straight in front of the keeper. I was slightly surprised that towards the end, Aaron Cresswell was hanging out of Josh King's shirt. I was surprised VAR didn't give a penalty for that. But I suppose it could be argued King had a hold of Cresswell's shirt as well.
Cresswell had much more of King than King had on Cresswell.
I just think also the way VAR has worked in this country so far. I mean, you could bring a baseball bat onto the field and whack someone upside the head, and the VAR, it's not really worth stopping play for. You know, the referee's decision, you know, there's an element of doubt there.
I think
not
we all
clear
are,
and
we,
obvious.
We are all intrigued to see what will be over, what foul will be overturned. Yes. It's really a great moment, you know. Pellegrini accused Bournemouth's assistant manager, Jason Tindall, of hassling the fourth official. Had a little argument about it at the end. There have not been enough manager arguments so far this season. In fact, there was a good question from Tim, who says, is this season's selection of Premier League managers the most likeable, least enraging in recent history? I'm finding it very hard to take sides, as I like and want most of them to do well.
Well, I think the lack of touchline conflict may have something to do with the absence of a certain Jose Mourinho, who tended to be involved in almost all of them until his dismissal last season.
And Mark Hughes isn't in gainful employment in the Premier League anymore, and I feel like a lot of touchline spats and ill feeling kind of were generated from Sparky.
A Pulis as well.
Just an overall scarcity of bellends, I think, on the benches around the country at the moment.
Okay, and that's a problem, isn't it?
Is it?
Well,
I think it's fine.
Okay.
I do think, I don't know, I can imagine, there are a few gruff characters, like, I don't mind them, but I can imagine, like, if something contentious happens when Sheffield United face Burnley, and we can have a sort of Chris Wilder, Sean Dyche face-off, that could be interesting.
As producer Jonathan says, a scarcity of bellends are playing Barfly tonight. some of their B-sides are tremendous, aren't they? Crystal Palace 2, Norwich City 0. In the same way that Isaac Hayden was angry that and confused that he was sent off, I enjoyed Amadou complaining about that foul for the penalty.
Yeah. I think tackling around the knees anywhere on the pitch is probably ill-advised, but definitely not in the penalty area. And you're right, he did a good line looking aghast for some reason.
Do you think he's just trying to convince their teammates? He's just trying to say, look, it's not me.
I think it's just so hardwired into footballers now. It's just what they do. It's almost like a completely subconscious twitch that they have, that they have to contest every decision.
It's like appealing for a throw-in.
Yeah,
exactly. It doesn't matter.
I enjoy how Crystal Palace, I think there's wide agreement that they have not been good this year, and they've looked like a team that could very easily get themselves relegated, yet here they are having picked up the same number of points as Chelsea. Is it Hodgson gonna Hodgson, I guess? That's what it is.
Yeah, it's a good point, Lars. Only Liverpool, Manchester City and Arsenal have won more points than Palace in 2019. Can I find that extraordinary?
Yeah,
I find
that is extraordinary. Yeah.
Milivojevic has scored 25 goals in 100 appearances for Palace, 20 of them penalties. That seems like a lot of penalties.
Well, they get a lot of penalties because Wilfried Zaha gets taken down a lot in the box or falls over, depending on your point of view, or a combination of both. And Milivojevic is a very, very good penalty taker.
Yeah, he really is. If memory serves me correctly, I think that's their first this season.
Right.
But even still, you're right, they do get a lot.
I mean, they've scored 6 goals so far. 6 goals and 7, and they got 11 points from it. I mean, that's well done.
It's economical, isn't it?
Very.
Milivojevic has played every single minute of Palace's league games since the 23rd of December 2017. Well done to you.
I think the only running he does, though, is just the run-ups for penalties.
That's his longest sprint, is it, on his Opta stats? What is it about Norwich? Is it just a case of them turning up against big clubs? They've scored against City. I mean, they beat City, didn't they? They scored against Chelsea, Liverpool and Newcastle. Failed to score against Palace, Burnley or West Ham. Or is it they're just not very good away from home? Scored 1 in 4 on the road and lost all 4.
That's a very difficult question, Max, to which I must confess I don't have the answer. I was very impressed with them against Liverpool. I think everyone was. Obviously, we were all surprised and impressed by them against Manchester City. But who was it that played after City? Was it Burnley?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And the tactics they employed against City, you know, I think Burnley were ready for them and they weren't able to do it against Burnley. You think, well, if you can do it against City, you should be able to do it against Burnley, but they couldn't. They haven't spent big in the summer. They haven't brought too many players in, and I have a feeling there might be 3 teams worse than them, but I suspect they will struggle.
They do have something like 9 players out injured.
Yeah.
Even amazing effort against City, but in general, for a newly promoted team to be without 9 first team players is generally not a good thing, especially when one of them is Alex Tetti, who, as we know, is the key to all the things. No Tetti, no party.
Now, Wolves 2, Watford 0. Game between the last 2 teams in the Premier League without a win. Matt Doherty's first after a nice sweeping move. And what a cute finish from Daryl Yammat for that own goal. I mean, that is a wonderfully cushioned header, isn't it? Watford had 61% of the ball, 14 shots compared to Wolves 6.
Watford are strange.
Okay.
I just got to double check this, because every time I remember the numbers, but every time I say them out loud, they feel strange. Only Man City, Chelsea and Liverpool have had more shots from inside the box than Watford. So it's not just that they're creating a lot of shots, they're creating a lot of shots from decent positions. And in terms of shots against, I think there's only something like 6 teams in the league who have had more shots against them.
So are they the anti-Burnley?
Their numbers suggest they should really not be bottom of the league. Now, these are very superficial number analysis. I'm sure there are proper stats people out there who understand this stuff better than I do. I'm very much a dilettante when it comes to the numbers, who can look at this, but it doesn't make any sense on the surface of it.
I wonder how much of their shot volume, though, is down to Delafeu, who does seem to employ a shoot on site policy as well.
He's taken the most shots without scoring so far this season, 19.
But they're not like they're not taking a huge number of shots from outside the box either. I mean, they're from decent positions, and it's very odd. It certainly suggests they shouldn't be bottom with almost no points and having conceded 20 or whatever it is. It's very, very odd, and you also wonder having played City and having had that game against City might also skew your numbers a bit. But then, yeah, it's very odd, and I think they're very unfortunate to have no wins in 7, and I suspect Gracia might be a bit unfortunate to be out of a job, actually, and I think they'll be fine.
Aston Villa 2, Burnley 2. That's a lovely finish from El Ghazi, isn't it? Because technically, to hit that ball like that is very, very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And but actually, I really enjoyed both of Burnley's goals in this game. I think Burnley are kind of my guilty pleasure this year.
Quite 80s, 90s.
Yeah, but I also think they've got a lot more going forward than people give them credit for. That front two of Barnes and Wood is quite old school. And then McNeil outside of them. I think they've got one of the best attacks maybe in the bottom half. I mean, I know that's not exactly really, really selling it, but I think Burnley have evolved quite well, actually. And you know, they went behind twice in this game, but they were back on level terms quite quickly. I think they're being underestimated as an attacking force.
And there was quite a lot of fun before the Jay Rodriguez goal, with sort of players like sort of being collapsed on the floor. El Ghazi had to go off. It was a good header from Jay Rodriguez. I was saying to Baz yesterday, I always feel I'm one club behind where Jay Rodriguez is. But this is his first goal for Burnley since 2012. So well done to him on his comeback to Turf Moor. What do we make of Villa?
They've chucked away quite a lot of points, I think 8 from winning positions, which suggests they're a bit naive and not very good at closing games out. I think actually in Dean Smith, they might have a potential replacement for Mark Hughes in the post-match whining stakes. He had plenty to say about various injustices after that game. But I think they'll be okay.
I think they've got quite a bit of talent when you look at them. I think you're right, there are probably some soft factors to work out, like not conceding when you go into the lead or perhaps holding the ball a bit better.
I mean, John McGinn is terrific. Mm-hmm. Grealish is good. I can't see them struggling.
Yeah, I would say that about McGinn. Like, in the summer, there was the story that he was linked with a £50 million move to Man United. And I saw that and I thought, what? And then I looked on the internet and Aston Villa fans were incredulous, saying that we wouldn't sell him for 50 million. And I thought, what? Have everyone like taken some weird psychotropic drugs that I'm not party to? And in hindsight, it seems like I was possibly the one in the wrong there, because he's looked absolutely terrific so far. And given the things United have spent money on, they might as well spend 50 million on him.
Having never taken psychotropic drugs, I do wonder if the first thing you do on a massive high is to think about the relative value of John McGinn, I'd be hoping for more, frankly.
You've got a bad batch.
In the Football League, West Brom have gone to the top of the Championship with a 2-0 win at QPR. Swansea stay second. They drew 1-1 with Reading. Leeds lost 1-0 at Charlton, dropping down to fourth. Forest move into third with a 3-2 win at Stoke on Friday night. Sheffield Wednesday up to seventh. They picked up 7 points in three games since Gary Monk took over this weekend, winning 4-1 at Middlesbrough, one of his old clubs. Derby, after a relatively bad week off the pitch, beat Birmingham 3-2.
Relatively.
I'm trying to be less sensationalist, Barry. Beat Birmingham 3-2. Two of their goals scored by players making their first start of the season, filling the gaps vacated by Richard Keogh, Tom Lawrence and Mason Bennett. Keogh's received the news that his knee injury is not career-threatening, but out for 12 months. In League One, Ipswich stay top, unbeaten with a 4-1 win over Tranmere. Wickham moved to second with a 3-0 win at Rochdale. MK Dons lost 2-1 at Sunderland. Well done, Parry.
Yeah, Max Power scored his second screamer in as many games.
Good old Max Power. Bolton, still without a win, going down 1-0 at Portsmouth, as our AFC Wimbledon lost 3-2 at filthy Peterborough. In League Two, Exeter stay top, despite a second game without a win. They lost 3-1 to Grimsby, moving to the playoff spots. Only one team in the top five won this weekend, Forest Green Rovers, who won 4-0 at Salford. Stevenage denied their first win of the season, despite leading for most of the game. Sam Smith scored a deserved equaliser for the mighty Cambridge United. Stevenage bottom. In the conference, Yeovil beat Bromley 3-1 in a game which was halted for 18 minutes at the start of the game because Bromley keeper Mark Cousins was clattered into and rushed to hospital. 10 minutes from the end, the fun started. Here's Yeovil's Twitter feed. 84 minutes, the referee has, no joke, just sent off one of our ball boys. 85, update, he's dismissed all of them. 90 minutes, the referee runs off to get a ball for Adam Smith, brackets, because he sent the ball boys off.
Well, what were they doing?
Well, the referee is Aaron Jackson, suspected they may be deliberately slowing the game down.
Mm. Maybe they were just very clumsy.
It's true. I mean, how deliberately can you do it? Were they getting it, like, booting it into the stands?
Well, I was a ball boy once, and I sort of dropped it at an inopportune moment, and I felt like a fool.
WSL, Tim, you were Arsenal yesterday for their win over Brighton. First goal since coming back from injury for Jordan Nobbs. Lovely goal from Viviane Miedemar. How was it?
Yeah, excellent, actually. Arsenal have, you know, they've had a lot of players away at the World Cup, so even though they've been winning, they've not been at their absolute best. But, they really, really clicked into gear. And anyone who hasn't seen it, because it's kind of on the FAWSL Twitter feed, look up that goal from Vivian Miedema, because it's outstanding football.
You spoke to her after the game. Great quote about her not being in the FIFA Pro 11. I think we all know it's all about popularity, and I don't post much on Instagram or Twitter, so that's probably what went wrong. I don't really give a shit about individual awards, to be honest, but I think it's a joke.
Yeah, and
the words of a woman who doesn't give a shit.
But the thing is, I really, really don't think that she does. And actually, the way I phrased the question, I said, I already know the answer to this because I've spoken to you about this kind of thing loads of times before, but, you know, were you surprised not to be included? And I should also say the brevity of the answer was probably down to the fact that it was a torrential downpour when I was interviewing her. So I'm very thankful to her for stopping. But we're kind of sheltering under an umbrella. But she was quite keen to get inside. So it was a quick and snappy answer.
Although you were telling me before the pod, you gave her a chance to edit this.
Well, it's really weird because it was so rainy. I ducked into a Nando's to kind of write the interview up, and she happened to walk in with Lisa Evans. So I kind of sat and chatted to them, So literally, she was sat right like within 2 yards of me when I hit submit on the interview.
What's Vivian Miedema's Nando's choice?
So it's just after they've played, right? Okay. So they need calories. So there was chips, there was coleslaw.
Oh, excellent.
But yeah, I think that's allowed within kind of an hour of the final whistle. But I can't remember the rest of it.
That's fine. Next time, more detail, please. Spurs won 2-0 at West Ham. Almost 25,000 at the London Stadium, which is great to see, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And West Ham made that decision fairly late. It was about 3 or 4 weeks ago they decided to do that. And really, really good crowd. And maybe not a shock result, but Spurs have kind of come up, and I think a lot of people expected them to fight relegation, but it doesn't look like they will.
Worth looking out. Rhiannon Dean's header was a brilliant header. West Ham had some brilliant chances when it was still 1-0. In the only game on Saturday, Manchester United picked up their first win in the WSL. They beat Liverpool 2-0. Liverpool still without a point. Is that a surprise?
No, not really. I think Liverpool are in some trouble and will fight relegation. I think, basically, the men's side isn't taking as much interest in their women's team as they have been in recent years. And, yeah, they had Chris Kirkland as manager and he left. And Chris Kirkland, when he left, said he was doing stuff like buying furniture for the players because the club was slow to stump up money and they've lost a lot of talent, so they could be in trouble.
Lauren James got United's first a day before her 18th birthday, in the same week her brother Reece scored on his first start for Chelsea against Grimsby. Do you reckon the James parents are more proud than the Madley parents in what their children have gone on to do?
So.
That was her first in the top flight after she scored 14 and 18 in the Championship last season. Disappointingly, according to Liverpool's post-match report, a minority of United fans sang chants about Hillsborough and made references to rats and robbers. In others, there were around 2,800 in attendance at the Lee Sports Village, United's home ground. The FA are investigating. Fitbar Corner, Barry.
There was Fitbar.
There was.
Rangers demolished Aberdeen 5-0. And Aberdeen are a team, they had quite a lot of difficulty seeing off last season. They played them quite a number of times, always gave them difficulty. But in mitigation, Aberdeen were missing, I think, up to 8 players through injury illness, which left them a little light in key areas, centre defence, midfield. James Tavernier scored 2, Alfredo Morelos got 1, Stewart and Defoe with the others. Morelos is getting a lot of praise for apparently a change in attitude. He was, you know, he was a red card magnet. He seems to have curbed his temper. He's getting credit for that. Steven Gerrard's getting credit for that. And you'd imagine if they can make Morelos more reliable, he will be a huge asset because A, he scores a lot of goals, and B, he, if he's no longer a liability and a red card waiting to happen, you'd imagine that would significantly increase his market value. Celtic dropped their first points of the season, drew 1-1 away at quite a feisty encounter against Hibernian. I saw most of this. It was a decent game. It was, you know, lots of thud and blunder. And both managers were unhappy afterwards. Paul Heckingbottom was sent to the stands because he lost the plot in the run-up, because of a foul that was given in the run-up to Celtic's equaliser. Celtic had gone behind. He kicked a water bottle and I think it hit one of the match officials, so he was sent to the stand. Then he gave out afterwards about various decisions that didn't go his team's way. Obviously, he didn't give out about the 2 penalty decisions that didn't go Celtic's way. I think both they should definitely have had 2 penalties. Heckingbottom less narked about those ones, as luck would have it. So he said, you can accept poor decisions, you can accept referees having bad games, but that's happened straight in front of his face. This was a, you know. So Rangers closing in on Celtic, and there seems to be that they could stop Celtic this season.
This could end the 10 in a row.
Possibly.
Wow.
But we've seen that. Can they beat Celtic in the league, though? That's the question. They could. There's no doubting their ability to beat everyone else, but can they beat Celtic?
We shall see. Thanks, Baz. Enjoyed that Fitbar corner. And it'll do.
I didn't think it was one of our better ones.
Well, I thought it had some content. we'll start part 3 with Sid in Spain. Welcome Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks very much. Granada win again. They're up to second.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting, isn't it? I mean, this is a newly promoted team, a team with a budget, which I worked it out last week, and I must confess, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's a 15th the size of Barcelona's, because, of course, they beat Barcelona a couple of weeks ago. The manager says, I'm not even going to look at the league table. I don't want to know about the league table. In fact, we won't look at the league table until week 38, and then we'll have a look to see where they are, which I think is probably not a particularly wise way of dealing with things. Obviously, they're not going to stay there. They're not going to continue that high up the table. But what it does mean, I think more than anything else, is 7 weeks into the season, you know, you look at it in terms of the points, and they're already pretty much, well, in fact, they're over a quarter of the way to go to safety. So it's a brilliant start for them.
And it's so tight, isn't there? Six teams within 2 points at the top there.
Yeah, and a good way of underlining that, of course, is to say that at the weekend, Real Sociedad played away at Sevilla. Sevilla, who were top a couple of weeks ago, but then lost to Real Madrid and then lost in midweek to Eibar. And of course, everything moves a lot when there's midweek fixtures. So Sevilla are playing against Real Sociedad at the weekend. Real Sociedad score after 4 minutes. And that goal momentarily puts them top, but they get beaten. And I think right now they're fifth or maybe even sixth. And so that's how tight it is. Look, the truth is that in all probability between now and Christmas, we'll start to see something a little bit more normal, that it'll be Madrid, Barcelona and Atletico Madrid at the top, that that gap will start to open up a bit, and that those three teams who've been pretty inconsistent so far will start to get results and maybe even start to convince, because it's not just that they're not getting results at the moment, the results are not awful, they're not playing particularly well, and that perhaps this will become a little bit more normalised. But for the time being, at least, it's really enjoyable. And I think there are some structural elements to the Spanish league which are improving. I think that the financial disparity is not quite as great as it once was, although, of course, I've just said that thing about the size of Granada's budget. And so, you know, it's pretty positive. And there are some teams that are playing some really nice football as well. And Real Sociedad were beaten last night, but they've been wonderful to watch this season.
How boring was the Madrid derby? Was the high point Sergio Ramos letting João Felix know he was there?
It wasn't very exciting, to be honest. And that was really early on as well. So João Felix is trying to run beyond Sergio Ramos. Ramos comes across and, I think, deliberately blocks his path. But that's not really the kind of the bit that says, OK, this is the embodiment of these two players. The embodiment really is Ramos then gesturing at him, saying, come on, get up. There was nothing there. Quite clearly there was. Probably the outstanding moment, I suppose, apart from a really, really good performance from Thomas Partey in the middle of the Atletico Madrid midfield. And actually, Kieran Trippier played really well as well. But the outstanding moment probably is the save late on from Jan Oblak, low down to his left-hand side, gets a really strong hand on a pretty good header from Karim Benzema. And that's been seen as kind of the moment at which the derby was settled at 0-0. But it was partly settled at 0-0 because no one was prepared to take any risks. Courtois said afterwards, look, we weren't going to go mad. No one wanted to lose. And I think that kind of sums it up. I also really liked the response from Oblak. This is a great save, the save that basically means that the derby finishes all square instead of Madrid winning it. And he's asked pitch side after the game about this save, and there's a kind of an excitement in the voice of the pitch side report saying, you know, that save is amazing, it's the save that gives you a draw, and Oblak says, yeah, it was quite basic.
You mentioned Real Sociedad's defeat. They had a 3-0 win on Thursday over Alaves, and one of the goals was set up by Martin Odegaard with just the most inch perfect passes, wasn't it?
It's just gorgeous. And actually, the thing starts with a nutmeg as well. He gets the ball, he nutmegs someone, and then he plays this pass. It's a kind of a pathway. You know how when you're at school, you used to draw those graphs where there'd be lots of little crosses and you draw a line that runs through the middle of them?
Yeah.
They're like a kind of a smattering of crosses. Well, that's what this pass was. It goes through about six or seven players. It's almost impossible. And by the way, it's almost as good as the pass from Banega last night against Real Sociedad. Martin Odegaard has been brilliant this season. I think there's genuinely a case to say that perhaps with Joan Jordan, Santi Cazorla, maybe Karim Benzema, that he's been the outstanding player in the Spanish league so far this season. He's been brilliant. He's provided more chances than anyone else. Admittedly, he's not top of the assist league because, of course, the assists require the person to then finish the chance off. But he's been absolutely brilliant. He's on a 2-year loan from Real Madrid, but they can recall him at the end of the first year. And you kind of suspect if he carries on like this, they will do.
I think the line of equal distribution? The intercepts that, of that linear sounds, equations?
What
is that?
Yeah, that sounds right. Admittedly, it's not a good idea to ask me about maths, Max.
Fair enough. All right, listen, have a lovely week, Sid.
I will try. Cheerio.
Speak to you next week, Sid Lowe, out in Spain. To the Bundesliga, Bayern prepared for Spurs by going top of the league. They won 3-2 at bottom place Paderborn. Philippe Coutinho getting on the score sheet for the second game in a row. RB Leipzig lost for the first time this season Schalke came and beat them 3-1 in their backyard. Wales. Rabbi Matondo scored his first goal for Schalke.
David Wagner doing a great job there with Schalke. They were not in a great place when he took over in the summer, and it tends to be a serially poisoned chalice. And 6 games in very early, but just 1 point behind Bayern Munich. Really, really good start there.
Yeah, 4th win in a row there. Dortmund's...
That's the one I missed. Wagner to Schalke.
Was it?
I didn't know that.
There he is. Dortmund continue their mixed start. They drew their second game in a row, held 2-2 by Werder Bremen. And Borussia Mönchengladbach up to 4th after a 3-0 win at Hoffenheim. Marcus Thuram, son of Lilian, got his 3rd goal. How can he be old enough to play football? I suppose Lilian Thuram might be older than I think he is. Got his 3rd goal in 2 game. Hoffenheim suffering since Julian Nagelsmann left. They're down to 11th, just 1 win in 6. From Germany to Italy, here's Nikki Bandini, who gives us her report on a perfect Inter.
That's right, it's 6 wins out of 6 now for Antonio Conte at Inter. It's all teed up very nicely for next week's Derby d'Italia, with Inter still 2 points clear of Juve at the top. They extended their perfect start with a 3-1 win away to Samp. A game that featured, let's call it, an eventful first start for Alexis Sanchez. He tried to claim Inter's first goal, which was a Stefano Sensi shot, which essentially just skimmed his bum on the way past. He then did score Inter's second goal with a tap-in from close range before getting himself sent off for a second yellow card while diving to try to win a penalty when his team were already 2-0 up. So all that in the space of 46 minutes for Alexis Sanchez on his first Inter start. He won't obviously be playing against Juventus now. They did their bit with a routine 2-0 win at home to Spal. And elsewhere, Milan got walloped 3-1 at home by Fiorentina. And it really was more of a walloping than that scoreline suggests, by the way. Meaning that they have lost 4 out of their first 6 games for the first time since the 1930s. Real trouble there for Marco Giampaolo, whose job is already the subject of speculation, despite the fact he only took charge in the summer. The other story that grabbed my attention this weekend, meanwhile, was Mario Balotelli scoring his first goal for his hometown club, Brescia. He joined them in the summer as well, but had to sit out the first 4 games with a suspension. They're hoping that he can be the man who can help to keep them afloat. His goal was not enough to rescue them from a 2-1 defeat away to Napoli, but very much no shame in losing there. And there was a touching moment before kickoff as well, as he carried his daughter Pia out with him for the pre-game handshakes. Now, you may recall that in 2014, Balotelli broke down in tears during a game away to Napoli because he had just had a paternity test confirm that he was indeed Pia's father. Pia lives in Naples with her mum, Raffaella Fico. So keep an eye on Brescia, by the way, because they're going to be in a relegation scrap this season, but they are playing attractive, ambitious football under manager Eugenio Corini. And besides Balotelli, Sandro Tonali is a real emerging talent in midfield, going to be one that has a big role to play for Italy in the future, I think.
Thank you, Nicky Mandini. To France, Groundhog Day, as PSG win 1-0 again, the only goal scored by Neymar late in the second half, the 3rd time this exact scenario has happened in their last 4 league games. They are top, shockingly. 2 points behind them, Angers, who needed a late equaliser to take a point against Amiens. Nantes won 1-0 at Lyon. That game kicked off at 1:30 p.m. to make sure it was available for the Chinese market. Lyon ultras protested by creating a free Tibet tifo at one end, huge across the whole ground. Lille in 4th, drew Nice in 5th, Monaco won for the 2nd game in a week. They beat Brest 4-1, move up to 12th. And congratulations to Dijon, who won 2-1 at Reims. They're the final team to pick up a win in the league this season. David,
they're finally cutting the mustard,
aren't they?
You've missed the only second only interesting thing to happen in France.
Oh, tell me.
Well, in Nice, I suspect dressing room harmony may have been affected by the fact Casper Dahlberg had a watch worth £62,000 stolen from the dressing room. He got the police involved. There was a bit of an inquiry, and his teammate, an 18-year-old Lamine Diaby Fadiga, has since admitted pinching the watch. Now, quite what anyone would want with a 62 grand watch in the first place is beyond me. But
sell it, I think.
What could it do?
No, I mean, why? What Casper Dahlberg wanted with a 62 grand watch mystifies me. But yes, his teammate Fadiga has admitted it was him, and will. What do you do in a situation like that?
Irish news. The FAI waited till 11:13 p.m. on Saturday night, peak time, on their Twitter feed. The board of the FAI announces the resignation with immediate effect of Executive Vice President, former CEO John Delaney. Statement to follow.
Yeah, that's an old trick of the FAIs. They wait till the deadline for the Sunday papers has passed before making these big announcements. I think the Sunday Times, who've been on their case for a very long time, were kind of across it anyway. But it's quite ironic that they're saying with immediate effect when he's been on gardening leave for several months. And there's a bit of an outcry in Ireland that the language of their press release suggests that Mr. Delaney is going to be leaving with a very, very big payoff, which people think he does not deserve because the FAI is in total financial crisis and it's largely his fault.
In the Welsh Premier League, Cardiff Met and Cefn Druids game had to be postponed due to a kit clash. Druids away red kit was too close to Met's maroon. If they'd taken their home kit of black and white stripes, there presumably wouldn't have been a problem. It's getting too peak. We have to wear our away kit at away games when it's the same colour as the home team. Tim says, being the kind of sad sack to have kept every edition of the pod since its debut in 2006, I can say the very first one, a World Cup preview, appeared on the 10th of May 2006. It was hosted by Jimbo alongside Marcelo Moro Iarajo, Richard Williams, Ben McFarland and Barry. Topics in the first pod were Theo Walcott's inclusion in the England squad, Messi and Argentina's chances for victory, a discussion about beer with Ben and a brief tasting session, and a roundup of readers' emails from Barry, who sounded like he was talking into a bucket. thanks so much, Tim.
Not much of change.
I'm very surprised Sean Ingle wasn't involved.
Well, Tim,
certainly his idea.
Tim, listen to the second one and let us know who was in that. We can just keep reviewing what happened in the pods 10 years ago. Tim, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.